Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. There is no question that religion and education have been intertwined in a symbiotic relationship from the most ancient of times. Many respected institutions of higher learning here in the U.S. have deep roots in Christian denominations, though most have become secularized over the years. And certainly, the two disciplines can coexist today quite well. But Americans have for decades treated this relationship with a bit of caution. We fought in court over the right to teach science over biblical allegory in the famous Scopes Monkey Trial. We disallowed teacher-led prayer. And we continue to debate just how the Bible should be taught in secular schools. And another controversial subject revolves around vouchers. Should taxpayer money be used to bolster the coffers of religious schools? Money that might be used to enhance public education. During the last few years, we've seen Trump appoint people to various cabinet-level posts who seem to be delegated with weakening the department they are charged with. A perfect case in point would be the latest Postmaster General, who seems intent on shrinking the post office to an unreasonable size. The same is true with naming Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. She has made a career of denouncing public schools in favor of pretty much anything but, and she's been a champion of vouchers, encouraging what she calls school choice. She's also been accused of turning a blind eye to religious activities in secular schools and not being a friend to LGBT students. With me now is someone who has followed these concerns with a passion. Today we'll discuss just where we are in these very important debates that may very well change just how America's children are educated. Elise Helgeson Aguilar is the Federal Policy Counsel at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Elise graduated from the College of William and Mary in 2008 with a bachelor's degree in government, and then received her law degree from University of Florida in 2011. There, she was executive articles editor for the Journal of Law and Public Policy, as well as the founder and president of the University of Florida ACLU. After law school, Elise worked on voting rights and electoral reform as a legal fellow with Fair Vote. She also worked on successful congressional campaigns in both Florida and Virginia, where we are speaking to her today. Hello, Elise.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. And before we go any further, I would like to extend my thanks to the Office of State Representative Padma Kopa from the 41st District of Troy and Clawson, as well as her intern, Natasha Vassen, for the remarkable job done in supplying us with important research information. Much of what we're discussing today revolves around the case of Espinoza versus Montana, a case that went to the Supreme Court. And so, actually, before we talk about Espinoza, Elise, let's have a little bit of background on Americans for the Separation of Church and State, because in lo these many years of Common Threads being on the air, I don't believe we've ever had someone from your organization, and I know they do important work. So before we get into Espinoza, let's talk about that. How long have you been around, and what are your important goals?
Sure. So, yes, I'm with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We have been around, actually, for a very long time, almost 75 years now, and it's actually really great we're talking about this issue, although we work on many issues related to the separation of church and state and religious freedom in a lot of fronts. You know, we are a nonpartisan nonprofit organization. We have a litigation team. We have our legislative and policy team. We do a lot of outreach and engagement with folks on the ground. But one of our really core issues is this idea of preventing public dollars for private religious schools. It's actually the reason that we were originally founded almost 75 years ago. And so it's something that's really core to the mission of AU. We see it as, you know, a really strict principle of the separation of church and state that the government should not be funding religious education and religious activities. So this is really, again, at the core of what we do.
So let's then start off, as I mentioned a minute ago, talking about the case Espinoza versus Montana, a case that went to the Supreme Court. Let's review that and also in the process of that, if you will explain the Blaine Amendments.
Sure. I'll start with those Blaine Amendments, which you'll note that I refer to as no aid clauses. And really, that's so many things is can be a matter of semantics, really, because these no aid clauses, which are clauses in state constitutions that bar the use of taxpayer funds to support religious institutions like houses of worship and religious schools, you know, these have a history that really goes back a long time ago to the 1800s. And around that time, there was a great debate over funding of religious education, and there was a push at the national level to enact this Blaine Amendment, which was pushed by a legislator named Blaine. So that's why these state provisions that are somewhat modeled after that national provision are called Blaine Amendments. But, you know, Blaine Amendments is really a term that is used by school choice proponents to say that this issue of preventing public funding for private religious schools goes back to really a lot of anti-Catholic bigotry and rhetoric surrounding the National Blaine Amendment, which, you know, there is some historical truth to that, that there was some, you know, that this was a push to prevent religious education and funding for Catholic schools. A lot of the schools at that time were already religious, and so there was a really a big debate about how the government should be funding these schools. But in the years past, in the centuries since that great debate in the 1800s, many states have chosen to reenact their no aid clauses and really have moved away from that history and really have seen no aid clauses as being a really important barrier to, you know, separate religion and government, believing, as I do, that no aid clauses protect religious freedom by ensuring that houses of worship and religious schools remain independent of the government and that no citizen is forced to fund, you know, religious instruction or to a religion that they don't subscribe. So 39 states across the country have similar no aid provisions, like the one that is at the heart of the Espinoza case. So going back to the Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue case, that's a case that the Supreme Court decided this past term. At the heart of this case was a tax credit voucher program that the state legislature in Montana passed in 2015. Under that tax credit voucher program, the way it worked was that taxpayers could donate to scholarship granting organizations, which were set up to receive those dollars. In return, the taxpayer got a dollar for dollar tax credit back, and the scholarship granting organization then would provide vouchers with those funds to students to pay for tuition at private schools. Because Montana's constitution has a no aid provision, which prevents public funds from aiding any school controlled in whole or in part by a church, sect, or denomination, in order to bring this voucher program into compliance with the state constitution, the Department of Revenue stepped in and they promulgated a rule called Rule 1, which prohibited religious schools from participating in the voucher program. So at this point in time, there were three families of students at a religious school in the state, Stillwater Christian School, and they wanted to be able to use the vouchers to continue the students' education at that school. And so they sued the Department of Revenue, claiming that their inability to use the vouchers constituted religious discrimination. So at the trial court level, the trial court enjoined Rule 1, finding that the state's constitution didn't require the rule, and it allowed the voucher program to continue to operate. And then in 2018, the Montana Supreme Court reversed the trial court's decision and struck down the entire program, finding that it violated the state's no aid clause. And so at this point, then the case moved up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they took the case this year. You know, the question before the Supreme Court was whether Montana's no aid provision as applied to this voucher program violated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court held in a 5-4 decision that it did, and it stated that if a state funds a private school voucher program, it cannot exclude a school based on its status as being a religious school. This case is a huge departure from decades of judicial precedent where state no aid clauses have successfully been used to bar state-funded voucher programs. You know, in fact, state no aid clauses have successfully been used to strike down voucher programs in a number of states in Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Virginia, and Vermont. And so this Espinoza decision really undercut state's abilities to foreclose, creating or expanding private school voucher programs. It undercuts state's no aid provisions, and it's a huge blow to public education and to religious freedom.
It is interesting how the term religious liberty is being used right now. It's being used in a way that some people would say undercuts the spirit of the term. And I can see some people saying that here is a perfect example of this, that no one is claiming that these people cannot go to a religious institution. The state isn't trying to close a religious institution down. They're simply saying that state funds can find their way into a private religious school, right? That ultimately is what is happening. It goes through a middleman. It goes through the parent, but it still ends up in a private school, a private religious school, correct?
Right. That's exactly right. I think your point is spot on, this idea of religious liberty, the way that, you know, I would see it as meaning that, you know, we keep religion and government separate to enable, you know, religious diversity to flourish in our company, in our country, to enable religion and government to both be separate and benefit from that separation and autonomy. That idea has really been flipped on its head. And sort of, if you track what's been happening in the Supreme Court up until this point, you know, ultimately, it's not that surprising that the case came out this way, especially when you look back to the Trinity Lutheran case, which was decided just a few years ago. It was kind of a similar case. You know, it wasn't about religious education, but it was about a state's no aid clause in Missouri. And in that case, there was a preschool that was part of a church in Missouri, and it wanted to participate in a state-funded grant program, which was providing grants to schools and entities to resurface playgrounds. And, you know, the state said under our no-aid clause, you can't take part in this because that would be funding of a religious institution. And that case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and that's when the Supreme Court said, you can't deny a public benefit, you can't deny participation in this grant program to the school based on its status of being religious. And, you know, that's where this case in Espinoza came out too, this idea that just allowing some sort of funding or opportunity for the school is discrimination against the school simply on the basis of being religious. But as you pointed out, you know, there's no coercion, there's no denying the school's ability to continue on as a religious entity, as a religious school, and teach religion and all that. You know, we're just saying that there should be a separation there, that there should not be government funds flowing directly to those schools to teach religious education for religious activities. And granted, there is a distinction between the Trinity Lutheran case and the Espinoza case because, you know, I would argue that religious education here is very different than resurfacing a playground, and is really, you know, the interest in maintaining that separation is actually much stronger here. But you can sort of see the evolution of this idea that refusing to fund religious programming or religious entities is somehow discrimination. And, you know, that just simply is not the way the Constitution is meant to be interpreted.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU Radio. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Elise Helgeson Aguilar. She is the Federal Policy Counsel at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And we're talking about the separation of church and state when it comes to education. So I'm curious. Let's say there was a federal grant and somehow it was written that everybody in the United States named Fred got a very generous grant of a couple hundred thousand dollars. And I would like that, probably. But then let's say somebody challenged that in court and said, no, that's unconstitutional. Maybe I would say, well, I want to fight to keep my money coming in. Or maybe I would say to myself, you know something, Fred, that really does seem unconstitutional. And I am going to break ranks with all the other Freds who are fighting for this money. And I am going to join the dissidents to try to get this overturned. My question is, Do you know if there are allies with you in the field of religious education, schools who would on principle refuse money funneled to them through any of the ways we're talking about today?
Yeah, I can say that definitely on principle. I don't know. I guess I don't know personally of schools that would turn down the money, but I can definitely say that there are religious denominations and organizations that definitely think that having funding for religious schools and houses of worship is very dangerous. Again, for the reason, you know, that we have talked about a little bit, that, you know, when religion and government are separate, that's good for both religion and government. But when a school or a house of worship is taking government funding, you know, there should be certain strings attached to those funds. You know, there should be some accountability. There should be some oversight. And certainly most religious groups don't want government interference or oversight into their religious matters. And that's, again, something that the Establishment Clause really is, you know, is there for, is to prevent that type of entanglement between government and religion. And so, you know, having funding, direct funding for religious education really blurs that line. And really, it's sort of allowing the schools to have it both ways, to say, you know, we're going to take this government funding, but yet the government can't interfere in our business. It can't, you know, it can't have strict oversight over what we do with those funds, over the education, the curriculum that we teach. And that's the public education realm. You know, certainly we all agree that there should be standards and oversight on our public schools. And yet when private religious schools get to take this government funding in the form of vouchers, you know, the government's just supposed to be hands off. And that just fundamentally, you know, isn't, you know, the way we should be as taxpayers, accepting that our taxpayer dollars are being spent that way. And we shouldn't be saying that that's appropriate for our education system either.
Sure. And over the last minute, I was mulling just exactly what I would do. And I would probably join the dissidents to try to get that struck down. But in the meantime, probably cash the checks as well. So I understand where the schools are coming from, who might be your allies. Elise, what is your take on the Betsy DeVos plan for education here in the U.S. as best as you can define it?
Yeah, I think probably in Michigan, you're no stranger to DeVos and her many, many years of wanting to privatize education. And certainly she came into her role as Secretary of Education with that viewpoint. I think it's no secret that she thinks that there should be greater privatization in our education system. You know, you can see it in the way she talks about school choice. You know, I think she's sort of now pivoted to this idea of education freedom, which is still the same thing as school choice. It's just sort of a rebrand. But this notion that parents should get to decide, that the ultimate accountability mechanism is parents and their decisions and whether they're happy with their decisions, rather than this idea that we should be funding our public schools and providing, you know, this public education system that is there for every child, no matter where they come from, no matter their, you know, their beliefs or their, you know, disability status or any number of things that, you know, private schools reject students for, but our public schools are really there to serve all students. And so she really pushes against this notion of creating this public universal school system and wanting to see, you know, public dollars diverted to private and religious schools. One of her big pushes at the federal level is this idea of education freedom scholarships. It's this proposal. It's been introduced in Congress by Ted Cruz on the Senate side, and I believe by Representative Byrne on the House side, and it would create a $5 billion a year federal tax credit scheme, which would sort of similar to the Montana tax credit voucher program we talked about. It would allow taxpayers to donate to scholarship granting organizations in their state, and then they get a dollar for dollar tax credit back. And then those organizations provide vouchers to students to attend private schools. And this is something she's really been pushing. You know, fortunately, she has been unsuccessful. It hasn't gone anywhere. But that is really a big sort of central proposal that she really has advocated for. And again, fortunately, she has not been successful in that yet.
Can you tell me why she hasn't been successful when for the first 2 years of her reign, she had all three. She had the presidency and both houses of Congress on her side, so to speak. Any idea what sort of resistance is being met here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it really goes to show that voucher programs are actually, you know, less popular than the school choice proponents would have us think. You can see this actually play out in Congress. When you talk about vouchers, there's a federally funded voucher program in D.C., the D.C. Voucher Program, which has been around since 2003, actually. And that, although it hasn't been popular enough to ever pass as a standalone bill, you know, Congress continues to authorize the program by tacking it on to, you know, omnibus spending bills and mechanisms that would prevent government shutdown. So it sort of gets passed by hook or by crook. But, you know, you can see that, you know, members of Congress will support the D.C. voucher program. But then when it comes to their own state, they actually don't want vouchers in their own state. And there's also a lot of pushback on this idea that the federal government should play a role at all. I think even, you know, the hardest line school choice proponents would say that that is really something that should fall to the states and that it's dangerous to have the Department of Education play any role in a federal voucher program, one that would give them more oversight or regulatory authority over the state. So I think those are some of the reasons that it's been unsuccessful thus far.
So public education, by my understanding, goes back to 1635. And I'm curious, how long have we been having this conversation? Any idea?
I think for a very long time. It's definitely not a new conversation. As you said, it goes back, you know, for centuries, especially as we just talked about this idea of public funding for private religious schools in the 1800s. Certainly that was, you know, part of the conversation. And if you fast forward to, you know, the mid 20th century, school vouchers were actually a tool, and especially in southern states, for white families to, you know, to flee the public schools that were in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education that were becoming desegregated. You know, lawmakers started pushing this idea of private school vouchers as a mechanism to get around that. And since then, I think the idea of private school vouchers and school choice has sort of morphed a little bit, but the conversation, you know, really is the same. It really still focuses on this idea of allowing parents to choose, of giving the choice to parents, you know, which really is a false choice, but, you know, it's sort of changed in the way it's talked about, but really it doesn't serve the populations of students that I think, you know, it's talked about serving, this idea of providing a mechanism for kids that are stuck in failing public schools, or that really need these opportunities, low-income students, these students that, you know, voucher proponents really say they're trying to serve. But if you really look at the history and how vouchers really play out, in reality, that's actually not the students that they most help out. They're really a lot of times helping kids that already have the means to go to private schools, that already are economically advantaged enough to go to private schools, just sort of gives them extra subsidy to attend private schools and afford the tuition. So the conversation, it sort of just continues to be reinvented, I think, as we move down the line of history, but it's been around for a long time.
Can you tell us what happened to those voucher systems in the southern states were really instituted to avoid integration? Did they stand? Did they collapse?
Well, yeah, I mean, some didn't, you know, get off the ground. Some were just tried to be pushed by legislators there. Some were actually, you know, the state no aid clauses barred those voucher programs in some states, which, you know, as we've talked about. Well, I guess we haven't really talked about the fact that, you know, no aid provisions in state constitutions have really been the main way that vouchers have been challenged across the states. And so some sort of met their defeat at the hands of state no aid clauses. And, you know, some just, I think, you know, politics changed in certain states and things like that. They fell out of favor. But I think it's something that is missed a lot of times when we talk about school choice. And certainly there is a huge push to fund religious education. There is a huge push from just, I think, you know, more libertarian factions and groups that want to see this idea of school choice and schools competing in a free marketplace, sort of that idea. But there is this history of vouchers being really rooted in desegregation efforts and in racism. And I think that's often ignored in the conversation. So, you know, I think it's good to remember, you know, while the conversation changes, that it does have these historical roots.
Elise, we are running out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but I have more questions for you, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to join us next week as well.
That would be great.
In the meantime, if people are interested in learning more, what's your org's, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, what is the website there, and are there links that people can become better educated?
Yes, absolutely. So you can find out more about Americans United for Separation of Church and State at www.au.org. And we also at AU are the co-chairs of a national coalition that supports public education and opposes private school vouchers, the National Coalition for Public Education, which you can find at www.novouchers.org as well.
Wonderful. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Elise Helgeson Aguilar. She is the Federal Policy Counsel at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And we're talking about church, state, education, vouchers, and religion. We will continue this conversation next week. Please join us then.